The Jacksonville Civic Council says it wants to find out if selling off JEA is a good idea. Good Tuesday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Just ahead, former CSX CEO Mike Ward gives his thoughts into a possible sale of the utility. He's heading up a special committee on this. What do you think? Get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, a special treat, Dolores Barr Weaver joins the show to talk about the Connectable campaign. And we've got to look ahead to tonight's Jack's Tree Symposium. Yes, a symposium on trees. We'll tell you about that too. All of that ahead this morning. But first this hour, more meetings and discussion taking place this week around town on the big talker, the potential sale of city utility JEA. The JEA board is set to meet today, and a special city council committee is also meeting this week to further discussions of the sale. Now, the potential sale of JEA, the city's biggest asset, would be the most significant decision that has ever gone before this council. Last week, eyebrows were raised when both JEA CEO Paul McElroy and Mayor Lenny Curry's chief administrative officer, Sam Moussa, both refused to be sworn in before the council. The council wanted them to testify under oath about everything they knew about the potential sale of the utility to a private entity. As all of that is playing out, another group, the high-powered Jacksonville Civic Council, will add its voice to the debate. The Civic Council, a group of business and nonprofit leaders, is forming a special committee to assess the pluses and minuses of a potential sale of JEA, the city's electric and water utility. Now, the Civic Council's views have helped shape debate at City Hall on other big issues for Jacksonville, like pension reform. We're beginning the hour with a closer look as we welcome Michael Ward, retired CEO of CSX Corporation. He co-chairs the committee on the Civic Council and joins us now in studio. Want to keep all the committees and different groups straight, Mike Ward. Thanks for being with us this morning.
Well, thank you, Melissa. I'm glad to be here.
And here's our question to callers as we speak with former CSX CEO Mike Ward on the Jacksonville Civic Council's role in all this. What do you think about a potential sale of JEA? What are your questions? Give us a call at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax, and we always welcome your comments on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. Mike Ward, in a moment, I can't wait to hear what the Civic Council is going to be doing with all this, but first I need to get your reaction to the flap last week when both the CEO of JEA, Paul McElroy, and Mayor Curry's right-hand man, Sam Moussa, who swings a pretty heavy bat at City Hall, both refused to be sworn in, would not testify under oath before the Jacksonville City Council committee looking at all this. Your reaction to that?
Well, I think they were advised that they would be best to have counsel before they did such a thing. So I think they're taking the advice of experts on these matters. I'm sure they will come and testify in the future once they've had a chance to prepare.
Right. And certainly a lawyer would advise them in that capacity. Still, though, critics an opening to say, well, if you have nothing to hide, why would you not want to be sworn in to talk about this?
Well, Melissa, I think the one thing when we think about this issue, it's highly charged. I mean, if you think about it, JEA is the most valuable asset the city has. They do a wonderful job providing service to us. They're a top quartile performer. They bring great jobs to the city. They have good finances, they have reasonable rates, and obviously it's a valuable asset. So there's lots of emotion and lots of opinions as to what we ought to do. And I think the more we can try to keep this fact-based and let some of the emotions calm down, let some of the politics calm down, and really look at facts, the better off we're going to be. And that's what the Civic Council hopes to bring to the table.
Right. The Civic Council, which you are chairing, the committee you're chairing on this, along with another member, Bobby Stein, yes, I believe, is going to look at the facts. Where are you in that process?
Well, we're at the beginning stages. And I think probably to us, the most important thing is, are we even asking the right question? This is all being framed as, should we sell or not sell JEA? We don't think it's a binary decision. I think we, in our view, we need to look at all the stakeholders here, and there are many. Obviously, the the people that purchase electricity and water from JEA, all the citizens of the city, because we really own JEA when you get down to it, the payments they make to the city, the employees of JEA and the suppliers of to JEA. And we really think we need to say, we have a great valuable asset here. Are there ways that, what's the best way to deploy that asset? And it could be sell, it could be keep as is, it could be subcontracting certain portions of it. It could be leveraging the excellent balance sheet we have to produce some cash. There are many options. And what we think needs to be is a thorough exploration of all those options to make the best decision for all stakeholders involved.
What about the possible straw vote referendum that could go before the voters this November? This is sponsored by two Democrats on the council who've raised a lot of concerns about the process, saying that it hasn't been transparent. Councilmember John Crescenbeny and Councilmember Garrett Dennis, they're saying the public should get the chance to weigh in, not just, you know, with all due respect, right, guys like you, an ex-CEO, someone with a lot of juice and connections. What about the average guy or woman's say in all this?
Well, one, I think the average citizen needs to be informed about this whole issue. And that's one of the things we hope to do at the Civic Council, is let's get facts on the table. And Melissa, it's interesting. This is a complicated issue, as you well know. But we think there needs to be, once some of that work is done, a way to make it in a form that's digestible for the average citizen, so they are informed and understand what the issues are. As you're well aware, to affect a sale or a major transaction requires 2/3 of the city council. So it's recognizing the significance of this. And I think if the city council and their wisdom says, gee, we not only want to have our 2/3 vote on this, we want the citizens themselves to have a referendum, I think that's something they should explore.
Is it your hope that whatever the civic council puts out on this will affect a potential city council vote one way or the other, will influence the vote somehow, or, you know, at least play a role in informing someone's opinion about it?
I think more of the latter. What we hope to do is bring facts to the table to help make informed decisions of what's best for all stakeholders, more than trying to influence it. We don't have a bias one way or the other. Our view is, let's get the facts on the table, let's explore the options and decide what's best for everyone.
And before we go to everyone's calls, lots of calls already from Mike Ward, former CEO of CSX. He's now with the Jacksonville Civic Council and co-chairing a special committee looking at the potential sale of JEA. It's 549-2937 to join us. What would you say, Mike, to perceptions as this whole thing has played out? The fix is in on this. Last week, people went to the funeral of a guy, former rabble-rouser, agitator, much loved in the community, a guy named Marvin Edwards. He called the donor class in this city, the power brokers, the syndicate. He said, they make the decision, and then that's what usually happens. And, you know, by hook or by crook, they get their way. What would you say to the perception that the fix is already in on this thing, and that people with a vested interest in making this utility private are going to make it happen one way or the other?
Well, I think a couple of things. One, I don't think there's any fix in, if you will. The mayor's and the mayor's office made it very clear they have no opinion on this. They just want an exploration of it.
Do you believe that?
I take them at their word. I think the fact that there has to be a 2/3 vote of the council, I think, is really critical.
Do you think they've botched it with the council already? Haven't brought them along properly into this process? Now they have adversaries on the council.
Well, Melissa, in hindsight, you could probably look at any process and say there may have been a better way to do it. And I think where we are is, let's be forward looking here. How do we make a good, clear, factual, transparent process going forward? You know, the cards are on the table. There's an issue of what's the best thing to do with JEA, and let's pursue that.
Let's go to your calls now for former CSX CEO Mike Ward. He's officially retired, but unofficially, I think he's one of those people that's busier than ever, doing a lot of civic involvement for Jacksonville. What do you think about this? The Civic Council will be studying the issue of whether or not to sell JEA. Where do you stand? 549-2937. Peter at the Beaches. Hi, Peter. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. My question is simple. What is the benefit to the residents of the city of Jacksonville to own JEA? And a related question would be, what is the downside to if we were to sell JEA? It seems that if it is just an investment, then we could take the money and invest it somewhere else. Or, what is perhaps more probable, we're going to take the money and spread it around to buy favors so that the next election will go our way.
Okay. So, the very question you're going to be deliberating, the pluses and minuses. What is the benefit of keeping it as a city-owned utility? What are the pluses and minuses to selling it?
Well, first off, I think Peter has it framed exactly right. What are the pluses and minuses of either selling or keeping? Obviously, we're at the beginning phases of our exploration here, but on the positive side, one, they do a lot of economic work. Not that a for-profit utility would not, but they're very involved in the community, helped develop Nocatee. Some of the things they did at Cecil Field may not have been something that a for-profit corporation would have done. They provide a headquarters city. I think they're a top 10 employer. A for-profit will probably centralize some things and lessen the number of immediate jobs in the Jacksonville area. I think there's some immediacy, say when we have an outage. If it's a locally owned utility, they're probably more responsive than a one owned from a larger system where they might have other more urgent needs.
Say Florida Power and Light, if they were to buy it.
Or any,
that would be one possible, one possible scenario.
Now, on the other side of it, gee, are we the best at managing a utility? We're a large municipal utility. I think we're well run with a high customer rating, good debt service, and our balance sheet, and reasonable rates. But you can always question: could it be better? Are there things we can do to make it better yet?
Todd on the south side, go ahead, Todd.
Well, thank you. Good morning. I have a question about what's the best way to use our money. City leaders want to get a big pot of money to invest in our future, but we'll be paying that back at a 9% rate because the for-profit entity that buys JEA will be guaranteed a 9% return. If we have projects we want to do, why don't we just borrow the money at 3% with public bonds and save ourselves hundreds of millions of dollars in interest payments or profit payments to the new owner of JEA? This doesn't make sense to me. Please explain.
Okay. Thanks, Todd.
Well, Todd, that's an excellent point. One of the things that we are not investigating at the Civic Council is if there is a decision to monetize any portion of JEA, what should be done with those monies? There's many people that have many ideas on what that might be. We are not viewing ourselves as ones that should weigh in on that at this time. We think that's really something more for the city council. You have an excellent point, though. We could borrow money. We could leverage our balance sheet some, too, as well, and provide some funds for some of these worthy projects. So I think that's part of what we're saying. This is not a binary buy or sell. There are ways if we need to create value. Can we leverage our balance sheet to create some of those monies for these great projects that are to be determined?
Ron is on JTB. Ron, I know you need to get on quickly. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, appreciate the opportunity. Mr. Ward, I tend to be against this sale. And the big reason is all the real estate that JEA has control and owns. And I just think there is too much wiggle room in there, values and sales and So I was just wondering if maybe you could talk about that. Thank you.
Okay.
Yes.
Good question. Thank you.
Thank you. The numbers that have been put out there, the 7 to 11 billion gross and 2.5 to 5, 7 net, we think are highly speculative at this point. There'll probably be some additional reductions if we ask for rate guarantees, employment guarantees. All of those would lower the value. But I think that... We really need to get a professional evaluation to understand all the assets
JEA owns. Where would we get that, Mike?
People that have that expertise. The group, PFM that did this, is really more of a bond rating organization than a valuation organization. So there are professional people that can come in and value all the various assets JEA owns.
And that gets toward the criticism of this potential deal, that there hasn't been enough transparency around the process, that there are so many moving parts to it. What do you think of that criticism, that this has sort of not been done in a fully transparent way?
I guess I would view it a little differently. If you're going to look at a major asset like JEA with all of its assets and complications, it is a 12 to 18 month process to really do that well. And I'd say we're at the beginning phases of that. You know, the city council has their special commission to look into this issue, which I think is very appropriate. And I think there will be a timely, thorough analysis of all these issues, because this, again, is the most valuable asset we own as a city. And it's really critical. I mean, they provide money to our general fund every year. If we don't have them, where
isn't
do
it
those
about
funds
$116 million a year?
I believe so. And it's guaranteed to raise every year as well.
Right. So if the utility were to be sold, the city would get this huge influx of cash, the amount of which we still don't know. But we would lose that annual contribution. So that.
Well, if there's a decision is made to sell, which should not be foregone.
If the decision is made to sell.
You could always put a condition that they would pay this additional $120 million every year, but that would lessen the purchase price you get. Mm-hmm. So all these things are trade-offs.
Steve is down in Palm Coast. Hi, Steve. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning. Good morning. Yeah, I work in the utility industry, and I have specifically dealt with JEA and a couple of big contracts that we've won and a couple that we've lost. And I've seen a lot of things throughout the state of Florida in the electric industry. JEA is part of the Florida Municipal Electric Association, which by default also makes them part of the Florida Municipal Power Association, which was started in the 30s for the municipalities of the state of Florida, particularly in the rural communities, to purchase power at a much less rate than the investor-owned utilities. To get to my point, the city of Vero Beach was purchased by Florida Power and Light. Well, it's not all the way through yet, but it's going to go through. They had to get agreement from all the 19 municipalities of the SMPA to do that. And I think that was like the shot over the bow. Once they acquire Vero Beach, they'll be able to acquire JEA. And I think this is just something that's going to happen. One thing I'd like to point out is that four of the city council members of the city of Vero Beach were essentially caught accepting $100,000 each from Florida Power and Light. This was made public in the city of Vero Beach, and I'm afraid that's what's going on with JEA behind closed doors. And you kind of talked about that earlier with the city council. And I just wanted to put that out there because I would hate to lose JEA as an account personally, but I think that's what's going to happen, and I think that's the way it's going to happen. And that's just what I wanted to say. To put
okay, yeah. Thanks, Steve.
Well, Steve, I'm not really familiar with the Vero Beach situation. I know it's been a very extended process.
It's still going on. Yes. It's not over. And that's a much smaller utility, too.
Yes. But if I think I heard you say there may have been some impropriety as far as payments to city council members. I would not be concerned about that. I think our city council is high integrity, high ethics. And I think what they will do is they will look at the facts and try to determine what's best for the city. You have a good point, though. You know, there's a reason for a municipal association, which is to provide lower rates because you don't have to get that 9% profit that one of our earlier callers mentioned. And I think that needs to be considered as we look at all the issues here.
And you said you're comfortable with the ethics of everyone involved. Earlier in the hour, I alluded to the perception among some constituents out there that they see, you know, nefarious motives around all this, whether or not that's true. But here's an email from a listener that sort of reflects the point of view of some in Jacksonville. It's Ira on the South Side, and he emails the show. The mayor stated that the pension tax revenue was a net present value asset and has borrowed heavily using bonds against that questionable asset to fund his self-interest. Why should JEA customers believe that he would not also co-opt a windfall gain from the sale of JEA and let his PAC, Jacksonville on the Rise, redirect the gains to fund their hidden agenda? Okay, and he's referring to the mayor's political action committee. Now, of course, we have no evidence of any of that, but I think that email reflects a cynicism, you know, frankly, among JEA customers and voters that there's just something not quite right about all this. There's something going on behind the scenes that they are not privy to. Could you speak a little more to that perception?
You may be asking the wrong person, Melissa. I mean, those who know me know that I'm somewhat of a Pollyanna. And I always try to look at what the good side of life, the good side of people are. And many times there's conspiracy theories out there of all these nefarious motivations. It's my belief that most of the time you find those are not true, and all they are is a distraction from merely looking at what's the best thing for the city.
Do you personally have an opinion on whether it's a good thing for the city to go private?
I do not.
You haven't
I have an opinion that we should get the facts together and really do a thorough evaluation. And if I were to prejudge what was the best, I may not be able to really see all the options available. So I think that's what we view as our role as a civic council, is to help get a fact base out there for not only for ourselves, but for the city council and all the citizens of the county to be able to have.
Lots of calls for Mike Ward, former CEO of CSX. He is part of a committee on the Jacksonville Civic Council, not the city council, the civic council that is studying a potential sale of JEA. David is in Riverside. Go ahead, David.
Yes, hi, good morning. I just wanted to say that, you know, I don't know if any of you are watchers of the HBO show The Wire, but there was a detective on there who said, follow the money. And I think in this case, you know, if you were to follow the money, you wouldn't know what you would get, but you'd probably find something very interesting. And I think that the people that benefit from the sale are probably not the ratepayers of the city, just because, you know, it makes a lot of sense to sell this private asset and use those funds for something. But follow the money is all I'll say.
Okay. Who benefits
from this?
But to
his point, we ought to really be looking, as I said at the beginning, we've got to look at all the stakeholders here and what is best for all stakeholders. And there are many here. It's the employees, it's people paying the electric rates, people getting the water service. You know, we don't talk about the water side of it much.
What would happen to water and sewer?
We have a very good, most water systems are underinvested in. Ours are not. Ours are in good shape. Nobody wants wastewater business. So we need to make sure we're looking at all of those and make sure that the service and the rates continue to be good for our citizens, because it's not only good for our current citizens, it's good for our economic development and bringing new industries and new jobs into the city.
Steve is on the west side. Steve, go ahead.
Hi, good morning. I really am puzzled as to why it's even really a conversation or sort of a weighing the short-term cost benefit of selling this. It seems like it's a self-proclaimed most valuable asset to our city. That's a perennial moneymaker. So, I mean, other than a short-term gain to anybody that it seems to gain, you know, financially, it seems like even if we were to get 10 times the value, you know, we would lose what we would have in 10 years. It seems like, you know, unless this was a failing or struggling or hurting or in some way, you know, potentially, liability, why sell something that's working, that, you know, has moderate to above average success and continues to make us money and be an asset for our community? There obviously is money to be made for some in this, whether it be short term or long term. It just doesn't make any sense to me why we would even consider selling such a valuable, or in your assertion, most valuable asset to our city.
Okay, thanks, Steve. Yeah, is this a solution in search of a problem?
No, that is an excellent point, Steve. And again, I have no opinion. We want to get facts, but those who advocate for a sale, their key points are, one, utility valuations are very high now with interest rates very low. And many utility companies, the publicly owned ones, not the private utilities, are looking to buy to get growth. So they said it's a very high valuation market. So that's one of the reasons people say we should really be looking. This may be a high watermark. And there's uncertainty as the future of the electric industry, period, because there's not been a growth in demand because of all the more efficient refrigerators, air conditioning, et cetera. But I also agree with your point of view that if we sell this, once it's sold, it will not have that same generation it does today.
Yeah.
That's why we need to put all of the pluses and minuses on the table.
What about the one point of criticism that's come forth, that whichever suitor comes to ask Jacksonville to dance with this thing, whether it's Florida Power and Light or another entity, that they would be using this type of purchase to write off debt and issues that they have on their books, and that the ratepayers would take the brunt of that, that we would almost inevitably see higher rates, higher electric rates, we'd see layoffs at the utility and all of that.
Right. Well, we might see higher rates, but you may remember, if it is a private company, they do have to get those rates approved by the Public Service Commission of Florida. So they're the ones that are looking, saying, is this a reasonable rate to be charged? The one difference, though, is they're allowed to have a profit. They can have a profit motive in the rates, which we don't have as a municipally owned. But they cannot get in here and just charge whatever they want to charge.
Steve is at the beach. Steve at the beaches. You're on the radio.
Hi. I have two questions. One, could you tell us the names of the people that are on the committee within the Jacksonville Civic Council that are will be working on this? And the second is, what is your opinion of having an outside consultant come in, not to just look at the valuations of JEA, but look at the whole deal?
Okay, thank you. And people are also calling in wanting to know if they can attend any of your meetings on this. Are they open to the public? Okay.
So, no, this is not a public, it's not a public forum where anybody that wants to can attend. And we're in the process of considering, and we'll probably release the names of all the committee members. Right now, it's known that it's me and Bobby Stein as the co-chairs. And I anticipate sometime in the near future, we will make the rest of those members public. They're all well-known. They're businessmen. They're community leaders.
And the city council committee is open to the public that's meeting on this for anyone that wants to go to that.
And to the question of experts, I think there will be a lot of experts to bring issues to or bring knowledge to bear on this. Because it's not just evaluation experts. There's experts on the future of the electric industry, fuel source. There will be many experts brought in. There'll be experts even on the rate-making process if it were bought by a private company. So I think you're going to find there'll be more experts than you could shake a stick at in this mm-hmm. process before it's all over.
And, of course, people on Twitter are all experts, right? I'm just joking around. We all feel like we are anyway. Here's a tweet from Nick. Stop. Just stop. This sale is bad for the city. The numbers do not add up. And if we sell one of the city's biggest assets, then what? On our Facebook page, we have a lot of commentary. Lisa writes, given the ongoing gutting at his former employer, CSX, by an outside group, I bet Mr. Ward has an interesting perspective. Of course, after you left CSX, a guy named Hunter Harrison came in to lead the company. Very controversial. He has since passed away. Is your former leadership of a railroad, CSX, how does that inform your approach to all of this?
So, Melissa, I've always been a very long-term thinker by nature, and I used to tell our employees that we need to play the short-term game good enough as a public company. We had to be able to produce sufficient returns, but we had to play a long-term game. Mr. Harrison and his team brought in a very different orientation, which is very short-term in nature, and have led to a number of layoffs, some issues with customer service, and I call it a very short-term orientation.
Was that hard for you to watch?
It was very difficult for me to watch. I spent 40 years at CSX, 14 of those leading the company. And it was a very different direction, and it was difficult for me. But I've been given wise counsel by my wife, Jennifer, who's a family and marriage therapist. She said, try not to pay too much attention. It will only frustrate you, upset you, and there's nothing you can do about it. So I'm taking her sage advice.
There is something you can do about this, though, at least in terms of giving your opinion. When might the Civic Council have its report ready on JEA?
So we think we'll have a framework that we can share with the City Council as they think about their work, as well as we can share with the public as how we think this ought to proceed. The first phase of it will be broad steps. For instance, what is the right question is the number one. Then probably within a month, we'd have a more detailed work plan. Where do we bring in experts? What things really have to be defined to make a great decision for all share stakeholders?
We hope you'll come back with an update for us when that work is done. In the meantime, thanks for joining the show.
Thank you for having me, Melissa.
He's former CSX CEO Mike Ward, now with the Jacksonville Civic Council. Much more still ahead later. They're focused on protecting the city's tree canopy. We've got a preview of tonight's big symposium on that. But up next, a special treat, Dolores Barweaver steps into Studio 5. Find out about the Connectable campaign next.
Follow what's happening at WJCT even when you're away from your radio. Get the latest news, event updates, and see what happens behind the scenes. You can follow WJCT on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Wherever you are, WJCT is there.
I'm David Luckin, host of the Electro Lounge, inviting you to join me Tuesday nights at 9 for Turntable Tuesday, only at the Electro Lounge on 89.9. Your community, your world, your music.
You've seen him on the PBS NewsHour with Judy Woodruff. Now join news anchor Hari Srinivasan for an in-depth discussion Thursday, April 19th at the WJCT Studios. VIP reception at 6 with a discussion at 7:30. Tickets for the event are $25. To purchase tickets and for more information, go to wjct.org/events.
Hello? Hello?
Hello?
Hello.
There you are.
One day the phone rang.
Hello.
Hello.
And it was him.
Hi there. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay.
Good. Hey, there we go.
What's shaking?
Hello.
Hello. Hello.
Hey, how are you?
Hey.
Let me introduce you to someone.
Okay.
He was just the most charming, welcoming, open, beguiling person you could possibly imagine. And he was nuts, which was a lot of fun.
Say hello to Awesome every week on Radiolab.
Sunday at noon on 89.9 WJCT.
Many people in Jacksonville never come in contact with those outside their core communities. WJCT is embarking on a journey called Beyond the Core to start a citywide conversation about what unites the people who call Duval County home and what makes our smaller communities unique. We might have an upcoming Beyond the Core listening event in your neighborhood. Check WJCTnews.org to find out.
Welcome back. It's a public awareness campaign focused on enhancing connections for local people with IDDs. What's that? Intellectual and developmental differences. The Connectable campaign launched last year, and its founders say it's making a big difference. March is Developmental Disabilities Awareness Month, so we're taking some time right now to update you on the Connectable campaign as we welcome Dolores Barr-Weaver, the funder of this campaign. Mrs. Weaver, a pleasure. Good morning.
Oh, thank you, Melissa. Glad to be here.
Thanks for joining us. And Renee Daigle is here of Daigle Creative. They've done a lot of the website and other work to promote Connectable. Good to see you, Renee.
Nice to see you. Thanks for having us.
Okay, so Mrs. Weaver, this campaign launched last year, and in the year since, you've really made a lot of progress. Can you tell us a little bit first off about what inspired the Connectable campaign?
Well, you know, Melissa, for some time, even without realizing it, I had trouble with disabilities. And even at the team, I would get all sorts of letters about various different things, and some were about disabled. And I would find myself acknowledging those by using differently abled, mm-hmm. thinking we're all different. You know, we all, some of us can write, some of us can do music, some of us can do whatever. So I was doing that, but it really dawned on me and made such an impact. A couple of years ago, I was at a grand event at a grand organization, and it seemed that every person who spoke, it was disability. Just, I heard so many of those. Mm. And actually, Kit Thomas here is a friend, and she's been involved in this this interesting abilities or disabilities thing for a long time. So I said, Kit, what's wrong? What are we doing wrong? This is just not right to label everybody as being disabled. She said, oh, my God, thank you. Thank you. I'm so excited that somebody else is recognizing this. So it really did begin there. And we did, you know, start out with me going to the Community Foundation, and because I wasn't capable of pulling all this together. So I went to the Community Foundation, and through that, you know, we hired Jody Leach, which is a mm-hmm. consultant, and did focus groups and all of that. And of course, Renee and her husband, John, from the Daigle group, Creative, you know, joined in and made it happen. So that's it in a nutshell.
That's it in a nutshell. And so, Renee, people can go to ConnectableJax.com, ConnectableJax.com. And there's been a huge response to this. Can you bring us up to date on what has been happening with it over the last year?
Sure. We've been thrilled with the response Connectable has received from the Northeast F- Florida community. Nonprofit leaders have seen the wider community open up to people with IDDs and the many ways they are able. Just in 5 months, we had over 12,000 visitors to the website. More than 350 people have taken the pledge to be connectable. And the pledge is really designed to be connectable at whatever level you're comfortable with. There's no reason not to connect. Whether you just want to learn more, the pledge is for people who want to learn more, who want to form a friendship, who want to volunteer, or ideally employers who would look into hiring people with IDDs. There's many ways they are able and can positively impact companies.
And when you talk about IDDs, you're talking about a whole range of folks, anyone who might have, say, Down syndrome or autism spectrum disorder or a number of other things.
Exactly.
And when people go online and take this pledge, they're not only pledging to learn more and become more aware, they're pledging to reach out to someone, mm-hmm. right? Mrs. Weaver, you want people to actually connect.
Oh, yes, we do. And, of course, you know, to get jobs, you know, everybody has to realize that these people are capable. They're capable of having friendships, being great community leaders and workers. And, you know, so we have to accept them and enhance what it is. And I don't think you do that by calling them disabled.
Right.
Yeah.
March is Developmental Disabilities Awareness Month. But as you're saying, disabled is a word that is certainly not part of this campaign, the Connectable campaign. Mm-hmm. It's connectablejax.com as we speak with the founder of this, Dolores Barr Weaver, and Renee Daigle of Daigle Creative. Here's an email from Jennifer on the South Side for you. Thank you, Mrs. Weaver, for your philanthropy. Mine is one of the many lives that you have touched. One day, your reward in heaven will be to see all of the lives you've touched.
Oh, my goodness.
That's pretty nice, isn't it?
Oh, well, she's very gracious, and I'll have to work hard to be deserving.
Well, and you have worked hard. I mean, the philanthropy that you and Mr. Weaver, Wayne Weaver, of course, former owner of the Jaguars, the example you've set for this community, the bar is very high. I mean, we do need to point this out. An incredible contribution in terms of your philanthropic giving, but you've really done more than that. And you've worked to raise awareness. And it seems to me over the years as I've watched you in this community that in particular, you seem to go out of your way to find ways to empower and help the most marginalized people in this community, whether it's people with IDDs, women and girls, people who are in poverty. Several years ago, I had the honor to MC the One Jax Humanitarian Awards, and you were one of the honorees. And when you accepted the award, you quoted the philosopher John Rawls. I don't know if you remember this.
Oh, tell me.
And you quoted him and said, and he was a guy who had a lot to say about dismantling structures of social inequality. Mm-hmm. And you said in your acceptance speech that you were devoting this part of your life to dismantling those structures of racism, classism, sexism, mm-hmm. and trying to level the playing field for everyone.
Yeah.
Is that central to your approach to not just this campaign, which I think is so important, but everything you're working on?
Well, I think it is. You know, people come from all different directions. We're all shapes, sizes, and fashions. And, you know, so I want to speak out for those that sometimes can't speak for themselves. And that's where I get my joy. And that's what I do for pleasure, is being able to help. And I'm just so grateful that I can do that.
And what was it about, I guess, your life experience that has oriented you so strongly in that direction, would you say?
Well, people ask that, and they say that you have to learn, be taught, but I wasn't really taught because I didn't grow up in an era that, or you know, certainly in a family that had money to give. And so, you know, and so I think you just learn along the way, but somewhere it has to be in your gut. And if it's inside of you, you can pull it out and do what it is that you know is right. And I think with this campaign, we're finding more and more people that want to address this issue. So I'm so excited about that.
And Renee Daigle, there are thousands of people in this community who you're trying to touch with this, people who have IDDs, thousands of people looking for friendships, opportunities, jobs. This is a way to connect the people that are that need the connections with the people who want to make the connections.
Exactly. One of my favorite things about this campaign is it's not about doing, you know, having an interaction with somebody who has an IDD because you feel sorry for them or you want to feel good about yourself or you want to just volunteer. It's really turned exactly around. It's about touching and reaching out to these people because you're missing out if you don't. You're missing out if you don't. These are amazing people with joy in their hearts who are very just differently abled. We're all different. And I have had such joy working with this community. And I do feel that people are missing out if they don't look at them for jobs. There are many jobs they can actually do better than others that are when they're detail focused. A lot of the repetitive jobs that some other people may not want to do that they embrace and love to do. They want to work. They want to have regular friendships. They are incredible. They are connectable.
And on the website, connectablejacks.com, you share some stories of individual people. People can go online and learn mm-hmm. about people that this campaign is helping, which is, I think, makes it a little more real for people.
Oh, sure, sure. Well, as long as you can touch it, feel it, or smell it, one of those things, it's always better for yourself to be able to do that.
Now, go ahead, Renee.
I was just going to say one of the other things the website does, you have vignettes about some of the wonderful people we met. And I think Mrs. Weaver is exactly right. If you connect with them, you'll see the value immediately. But one of the things I like, too, is there's actually resources. There's fact sheets. A lot of people are afraid that they'll just make a faux pas, that they're afraid they won't be politically correct. And that holds them back. There's one of my favorite fact sheets on there is an approachability fact sheet. How do you start that conversation? What should you maybe not say or say so that you'll feel more comfortable?
It's all at connectablejacks.com. When you take the pledge at connectablejacks.com, it's a simple thing to do, but you're pledging to connect to people with intellectual and developmental differences. You're making a promise that you will positively impact this community, but also the community at large. Go online. It is the awareness month to do this. Go online to connectablejacks.com and take the pledge. Two women that have already done it are here today, and we're so pleased to host you, Dolores Barr Weaver and Renee Daigle. We thank you both so much for joining us. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Again, that website, connectablejacks.com. A quick break, and when we come back, it's your chance to learn about how to preserve this city's lush tree canopy. That's tonight. We'll have a preview of tonight's tree symposium. Yes, there is such a thing. And that's after this.
Community hospice and palliative care. Since 1979, the compassionate guide for more than 200,000 patients facing advanced illness in Northeast Florida. Today, serving 16 counties, including yours. Available 24/7 to help you and your loved one. More at choosecommunityhospice.com.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Personal Injury and Wrongful Death Law Firm. Injuries can happen when you least expect it. For over 40 years, our attorneys have dug out the facts to help juries decide what happened and who's at fault. More at waynehogan.law.
Facebook data has been used in elections before, but never like this. Cambridge Analytica consulted for the Trump campaign. Lawmakers in the U.S. and the U.K. want to know how Cambridge grabbed more than 50 million Facebook profiles, monitoring and manipulating millions of voters before the election. Is Facebook still a force for good? Next time on 1A.
Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
on the next Fresh Air, how early Christianity expanded from a small group to the religion of the Roman Empire. We talk with religion scholar Bart Ehrman, who's written a new book on the subject. We'll also talk about his own conversion from born-again Christian to being a self-described Christian agnostic. Join us weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Let's say there's a crisis and somebody's got to do something.
If the regulators don't have the tools they need to work with and have to go to Congress to get them, what the cost to the economy could ultimately be.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, Paulson, Bernanke, Geithner, and the Fall of Lehman Brothers next time on Marketplace. Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Finally, this hour, it's your chance to learn about how to preserve Jacksonville's lush tree canopy. The Jacksonville Tree Symposium is coming up this afternoon and evening at Downtown Intuition Aleworks. Yes, a symposium on trees. John November is Executive Director and General Counsel for the Public Trust Environmental Legal Institute of Florida, and he's here with more about this. It's a symposium for trees. Pretty interesting. Hey, John.
Hey, glad to be here.
How'd this come about?
Well, we've had a really great collaboration with the city of Jacksonville since the settlement we had last year, where we're really trying to revolutionize our city's urban tree forestry practices. And we've been doing that through the use of some really state-of-the-art technologies that are going to allow us to plant trees in the most effective way possible over the next 3 or 4 years.
And what was that settlement again? Refresh my memory.
Yeah, we had a settlement over the inadequate enforcement of the tree ordinance and the failure to spend the funds in a way that was in line with the law. But they've come full circle, and I've been so impressed with the way the city has come to the table and worked together. In fact, the urban forester Ricky Leon is going to be at the symposium this afternoon talking about how important green infrastructure is and how trees provide that green infrastructure for our city and how important that is moving forward.
There seems to be a widespread devotion to Jacksonville's tree canopy and a sort of universal consensus that we need to try to preserve it. We've got a pretty good tree canopy. So you want to make it better, though. So what all is on the agenda for this afternoon and tonight?
Yeah, the main thing that we're going to be talking about today are online mapping technologies. We've been able to actually get a 1 meter resolution map of the entire 700 plus square miles of Jacksonville, so we can see where the trees are and maybe more importantly, where they're not. So actually the founder of Planet Geo, one of the nation's leaders on online mapping technologies, will be here to talk about the technologies and how other local communities and regional communities can benefit from this technology as well. And people can learn about how they can get involved in the tree planting process, where we have over $21 million worth of trees to plant in upcoming years.
How would you rate Jacksonville in this sphere as compared to other cities when you look at how we preserve the tree canopy or not?
I think we're on our way. Places like LA and New York have made 1 million tree pledges. So we have the opportunity, due to some mitigation funds that we have available, to really make some sweeping revolutionary changes in the way we do urban forestry. And I'm really pleased to be working with the city and lots of stakeholders through the Jacks Digs Trees movement to get the community involved. So if folks are interested in joining this movement, go to jacksdigstrees.org to learn more, or join us on Facebook at jacksdigstrees to hear more about the symposium.
jacksdigstrees.org, a good name. Mark is up along the Dames Point Bridge. He's calling into the show. Hi, Mark, you're on the radio. Go ahead. Go Hello? Ahead, Mark.
Oh, yes, good morning. I was just curious. I wanted to ask your guest about why are they cutting down all the trees at major intersections like 295 and I-95? That might be more of a DOT requirement, but I've just noticed over the past year or so, it seems like they're just trimming back a slew of trees along the highway as well as major intersections.
Sure. Great question. And, you know, you hate to see that, but you see that a lot. What about that? Will that come up tonight?
Yeah, that's generally a maintenance issue. There may be some kind of issue with the trees spreading disease, or they may need to fix the interchange. So if they take those trees out, FDOT does a really robust job of replanting them. And so it's sometimes it's good to have an uneven stand, so younger trees and older trees, because in Jacksonville, we have a lot of aging water oaks and laurel oaks that were planted right after World War II that are going to need to come down in the next couple of years. Well, when we take those trees down, we need to plant new robust trees right where they are.
There are a lot of groups working on this too. There's Greenscape of Jacksonville, there's Scenic Jacksonville, there's your group, Jax Digs Trees. Is everyone coming together for this symposium?
That's the point. The point is to show a unified front. Greenscape and Sierra Club and Scenic Jacks and the Public Trust have all come together to try to mobilize the community. I'm meeting with UNF professors next week to try to get the students involved. You know, people are going to ask, well, how is this going to change our community? And I think that they'll walk out into the community and say, man, I wish there was a tree there. Well, maybe now there will be. And that's going to be really cool.
Anyone can come. Things kick off, what, 3 o'clock today at Intuition Aleworks?
Yeah, we get to have a good time, drink a few beers. At the professional session between 3 and 6, we're going to get really detailed. And then starting at 6, we're going to have a community session where folks are going to have the opportunity to have some fun, learn about what's going on, and see how they can get involved.
It's tonight, this afternoon and tonight, the Jacksonville Tree Symposium at Intuition Aleworks in downtown Jacksonville. Come on out. It's free and open to the public. John November with the Public Trust Environmental Legal Institute of Florida. And that website, again, is jacksdigstrees.org. I love that name.
Thank you.
You couldn't use Tree Hugger. I think that was already taken.
Yep, that's right.
So jacksdigstrees.org. Thanks, John, for being with us.
Thank you so much, Melissa.
All righty. And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Merschart. Michelle Corum runs the board during the hour. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. If you missed anything this morning, catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock. 1A's up next as lawmakers demand to know what really happened with Facebook and Cambridge Analytica in 2016. But are they too late? That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.